Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Hemant Mehta.
And I'm Jessica Blimke.
And you're listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. You can now listen to all of our episodes and see show notes at FriendlyAtheistPodcast.com.
By the way, we now have a merchandise shop on the website. So if you want your podcast swag, and you know you do, go to our website and click on the store tab.
Monic Miller is senior counsel at the American Humanist Association's Abignani Humanist Legal Center. If the AHA is involved in a lawsuit, she's the person doing the legwork. And that involves everything from letters to city councils to amicus briefs for the U.S. Supreme Court. Monica, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, I'm happy to be here.
So is this the job you thought you would be doing coming out of law school?
That's a good question. Coming out of law school, I guess yes, in a way. I had done some summer internships at AHA. In fact, both of my summer internships were at AHA because I enjoyed it so much. And I spent a semester in practice actually working at the legal center. So I'd already had about, 8 months under my belt before graduating from law school. And I was really hoping to do, obviously, separation of church and state work. And I was fortunate enough to have a position created for me to come on board and do this stuff pretty much full time.
And they've really ramped up how much legal work they seem to have been doing, at least from an observer's perspective in the past few years since you came on board, too. Is that fair to say, or were they doing a lot of legal stuff before you?
I think it is fair to say. I think when the Legal Center started, it was primarily involved in amicus activity, which is just friend of the court briefs, some cease and desist letters, but we really weren't a full litigation center, until the last couple years.
What was the first time you guys kind of rolled out all of your sort of legal prowess?
Can you say that again?
Yeah, when was the first time you guys kind of rolled out all of your legal prowess? Like, what was your first sort of big case, I guess?
Okay, big case. That's also a good question. I think the AHA as an organization had a few cases, back 10 to 30 years ago that weren't really done through the AHA, but outside counsel. As far as since we've been on board through the Abignani Humanist Legal Center, it's hard to say what are the biggest ones. We have several that are pending before federal courts of appeals, and I think for that reason we consider them pretty major cases, because once you have a federal court of appeals involved, the law that the case creates has a bigger impact. Mm-hmm. So we have one, for instance, that is involving graduation prayer, and graduations being held in Christian venues at the same time. So you get a prayer and you're surrounded by Jesus at the same time. I think they're all pretty important cases. So it just sort of depends on how you define big or landmark. I think when we've sued the federal government twice now, and I think those cases tend to be higher profile just because it's the federal government as opposed to a school district defendant.
What drew you to church-state separation law as opposed to any of the other kinds?
Okay. I should preface this by saying I'm actually also an attorney at the Non-Human Rights Project. It's a more or less a part-time position because we're doing, it's more of a project-based thing, but we have started animal law related lawsuits as well. So with that in mind, I actually was always interested in doing some sort of animal rights animal welfare type of law when I was an undergrad. And I chose a law school that was specialized in environmental law because it was the closest thing kind of to the type of animal law I'm interested in. But in law school, I started taking con law classes, and I was already an atheist and was familiar with some people in the movement, but just on a very small scale. And as I was taking constitutional law, I just became extremely interested in church-state issues and the importance of the Establishment Clause within the First Amendment. And I reached out to attorney Michael Newnow because I read about his case in our textbook. It was the Pledge of Allegiance case. And I thought maybe he'll have some suggestions on either where to work or maybe I could help him out with some of his cases. And he was very happy to have free law school help. So I got kind of involved in the movement just through him and then learned about the Humanist Association, I guess, sometime in my first year. And I guess just all stemmed out of that.
How much of the work you do now did you actually learn in law school? And this is just my ignorance about how law school works. But, like, how much of this did you learn on the job where, you know, yeah, you're a lawyer, you know kind of how to write letters and briefs and stuff, but I assume this is not one of those specialties. Maybe I'm wrong.
Isn't your wife a lawyer?
She's a different type of lawyer, though. And and she would tell you the same thing, which is that a lot of the stuff she's doing, she does family law, custody stuff. A lot of the stuff she's doing now, she never really did in school.
Fair
she
enough.
Just picked up the bulk of it
on the job.
I thought
you just ignored your wife, like, all the time.
Well, that too, but, you know.
That's a great observation. In fact, I think it's one of the biggest flaws of law school in contrast to other graduate school programs such as medical school, where you're required to work in a hospital or a medical center and get hands-on experience with the type of work you'll be doing for the rest of your life. Law school is very academic, textbook, very little hands-on practice. So the short answer is no, I didn't learn the skills that I practiced necessarily in law school. We learned, how to write briefs a little bit and how to argue before a court. But just again, these are, one class would be appellate advocacy. It's not part of the curriculum. However, I picked Vermont Law School, not only because I, it had the environmental program that I liked for the animal side of my world, but it also had a pretty good clinical externship type program. So that was what allowed me to work at AHA for an entire semester and get full school credit for that. And had I not done that, I think, I wouldn't be nearly as prepared to take on the tasks that I did coming right out of law school. I mean, by the time as an intern, actually my first internship assignment in my first year of law school was to write a brief to the Supreme Court and then one to the, I think it was at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And at that time, I probably had only written, maybe a brief or two, in law school, so it
That's
really threw me
forward.
Right into the practice and helped a lot for the coming years.
So you mentioned already that you have worked for animal rights associations. How is there a crossover there between the AHA and your animal rights work, or are they pretty siloed?
Very different, no conflict, but very different types of law and what we're actually doing at both of them. If anything, the overlap that I see is through humanism as a movement, as opposed to the legal side of things.
Oh, sure.
I know a lot of humanists that are vegans and see sort of a humanist obligation to be ethical towards non-human animals, to consider them as part of us as opposed to something separate. So there's overlap with humanism and animal rights. I'm not sure really if the legal stuff is really overlapping.
Stepping aside from your role at the AHA, let me ask you, what do you think are the biggest church-state separation issues facing our country right now?
Okay. The biggest, the most immediate ones that come to mind are less about the Establishment Clause, which is what we traditionally consider the church-state clause, and more conflict between, I want to say, equal protection rights, with the LGBTQ community, as well as conflict with the, women's rights under the Equal Protection Clause. We've seen in the recent Zuba case that religious organizations are trying to prohibit access for women to receive contraceptives. So right immediately, we're seeing religious groups trying to get, I want to say, I don't think exemptions are the right word. I think they're trying to basically infringe upon the rights of others through the guise of religion. So that's kind of the most immediate thing that comes to mind. I think the other things are, you know, what we see in the South all the time, in public schools especially. I think public schools are the main area that I'm mostly concerned with, because they're, you know, children are vulnerable, and with the religious right sort of forcing Christianity down the throats of our youth, it's a little bit troubling.
I'm curious about, when you talk about public schools in the South, if nobody comes to you and says, hey, my kid is in school, or I'm in school and they're making us pray, or they're saying this, that, or the other, is there anything you can do without somebody approaching you first, or can you kind of jump in on your own?
Almost without exception, we need a complainant to come forward to us. And that does pose a problem, because a lot of parents and other people, members of society, do not want to be named in a public document that identifies them, A, as an atheist, and B, aligning themselves against either their school or their government. So it is an unfortunate part of this, because really the government shouldn't be acting unconstitutionally whether or not there's a plaintiff involved, but that is what we're faced with.
Can they ever say to you, you know, hey, this is, they're preaching in my public school, we want to be anonymous? What leeway do they have to maintain that anonymity? Do they ever get it, or is it only in certain parts where it's like, yeah, we can send a letter to the schools without giving you away, but if you actually want to file a lawsuit because the school isn't going to change, you're going to have to be public? Like, what's the line at what point they can't have anonymity?
You've pretty much identified our typical response to these types of situations. We do say, you know, you can be anonymous in a letter. And, you know, with the caveat that if you're the only atheist in town and someone might know that, or if something specific happened in your child's classroom, they might be able to figure out who you are. So we need to be careful, especially in the school systems where, you know, kids can be more susceptible to being bullied and that kind of thing, to be clear that they should be assuming the risk that they could be identified. But yes, we normally do, even if they want to be named in the letter, you know, as opposed to a lawsuit, we caution against it, just because we don't want it to be about that person. We want it to be about the issue that we're dealing with. It just kind of becomes a distraction. And then, you know, but then as far as the lawsuits go, actually in the public school context, usually the courts will allow plaintiffs to proceed pseudonymously or anonymously, you know, by going by a Jane Doe or just the initials, like MB, for example. We had an MB case. And so, you know, you'll have to move for it. So it's not a guarantee, but it's still, we're still operating under the same assumption that we do with our letters, which is be prepared to be identified, because often the government, even if you can seal the student's name from the public, the government often has the right to know who the student is, so they can verify that, you know, we didn't just make them up for standing purposes. So we do have to have them be fully prepared for the worst.
I'm curious whether anybody ever comes forward who isn't an atheist, who might say, like, yeah, I'm Christian, but I see the problem with praying in public school, or
I'm a Christian, but my teacher was preaching in the classroom.
Right. Does that happen ever, or does it tend to be atheists or people with atheist parents who come forward?
It's actually, surprisingly, I would say almost a third of our clients, either in our cases and that come to us with letters, maybe less for the letters, because we do get a lot of students complaining about having to say the pledge because of the under God language. So if you take those out of the equation, I'd say about a third of them are usually Christians. And of course, in the South, being a liberal Christian is a whole different thing than being, you know, conservative Christian. So to them, atheism and humanism is, you know, almost closer to their beliefs than the type of Christianity that you see in the South. So when I say the South loosely, I mean, you know, rural pockets where you see the most conservative Christians. And so, yeah, we do. And the courts have been very clear that it doesn't matter for the Establishment Clause whether the government's promoting your religion or another religion. The point is that the government can't promote religion. So if you come to us and you're a Christian and you're saying, you know, I don't feel comfortable with the school teaching my kids this brand of Christianity or just Christianity in general, and the same applies for you know, Judaism. There's plenty of cases where one sect of Judaism will be suing the government for promoting another sort of brand of it, or just in general. Just sort of depends on who the person is. But yeah, it doesn't make a legal difference. But we do see it actually pretty frequently.
A second ago, you touched on the idea of the under God language in the pledge. What are your thoughts regarding that and regarding In God We Trust on our money and so forth? Do you think that's something we'll ever see go away, or are we just kind of stuck with it?
I sure hope we're not stuck with it. The first kind of in that I had in this legal center, or this separation of church and state world, was with Michael Newdow, who's known for his under God litigation, and now he's challenging once again the motto under In God We Trust. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be pessimistic, but the way that the courts have been treating these cases is not good, and I completely disagree with them. I mean, clearly, God is a theistic term, and promoting it in our coinage and in our daily pledge are clearly promoting religion.
Right.
So I don't. It's very challenging, and so that's why at the AHA we have done our we did launch our Don't Say the Pledge campaign, because realizing that the courts are not giving us the vindication that we're hoping for, we want to rally students and have them sort of have a voice in this and take a stand and at least bring to light the fact that this isn't some neutral language, but it is language that marginalizes atheists and humanists and makes them feel uncomfortable in their schools.
What's the justification of the courts? Is it because they're not saying one nation under our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ? They're just saying God, and they believe that's generic enough. Is that kind of the justification?
Yeah, that's basically it. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And, you know, David Niosi, our legal center director, has made this argument in court. But, you know, if it was one nation under white people, we wouldn't accept that either. I mean, so it is the court making a judgment call, and I think a very subjective one, that somehow God is neutral because, you know, I guess the assumption is that everyone believes in God and atheists shouldn't be offended by the word. I can't really wrap my head around the logic, but I think that's basically what the courts have been saying.
Yeah, I'm curious if in 30 years, if sort of demographics stay what they are, you know, millennials are the least believing generation ever, if that trend continues and people don't fall back into religion as they get older, I'm curious if that will change, because I don't think in 30 years or 50 years the default is going to be you just assume somebody believes in God unless they say otherwise. So I'm curious how that shakes out in the next couple decades.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I mean, usually the law sort of follows the social patterns. So that's, you know, when we saw the LGBTQ movement was very successful in the, you know, getting same-sex marriage, you know, on the books, because they were able to mobilize sort of the public into being on board, and then we saw the law follow social norms a little bit. And so I think you're right that if society shifts in such a way that there's no longer an assumption that everyone believes in God, or that God belief is the default, I think you will see a shift in the courts, you know, looking at it in a different way. I'd hope that future is closer than later, but yeah, that's a good point.
But then I wonder if the flip side of that is, like, people, you know, people our age, Hammond, are so, like, they can't get their heckles up about, like, In God We Trust. They're like, oh my God, we have bigger shit to worry about than, like, right. What our coins say.
This generation apathetic? Never.
Oh, how dare you, sir?
The apathy, I think the apathy's probably always been there. You know, when you read these lawsuits or these court decisions, even from 50 years ago, the Supreme Court would be very clear that, you know, against an argument that something is a de minimis injury, or, you know, a single prayer shouldn't amount to much. But the Supreme Court, at least, has been very sensitive to the fact that just one violation, just one, you know, making one person feel uncomfortable because the government's promoting religion is too much.
Yeah.
I don't know how to convince teenagers to not be apathetic about constitutional rights. That might just be a problem forever. But
there's,
you know,
plenty of things they don't give a shit about.
Right. This is just one of many that they might not care about. But it's, you know, I can't, we're here doing constitutional law. I'm not going to say that, our the type of law that we do is more important than, say, you know, helping the homeless or doing another public service type of law or public service issue. I think they're all in some ways equally important. Sometimes one might be, you know, have a greater immediate need. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that spending time trying to prevent the government from violating the Constitution is not important.
Yeah, and I think that's also, you know, I'm the one who said it, but like, I think that's also like a tricky path to start walking down of like, oh, well, we shouldn't worry about X because we've got Y to worry about. And then like, then you can't do anything until like world hunger is solved. And then we can start working on like gay rights again.
And that's how Donald Trump becomes president. Yeah.
Right. I actually had a very interesting situation that involved that issue in law school because, like I said, I am an animal rights activist, and I had a turkey drive around the time of Thanksgiving to raise money for Farm Sanctuary, a sanctuary that takes in, you know, farm animals that were going to be used for food. Or and so, but some women at the law school had a big problem with it because I was taking away somehow the money that would be otherwise given to homeless people. Mm-hmm. And of course, a lot of the professors saw the flaw in that argument, which was just that, you know, people can choose however they want to donate their money, and they can donate their money to both a, you know, a homeless shelter and an animal group. They're not mutually exclusive. And mm-hmm. I think it's just one person. And of course, this woman wasn't doing anything herself to help
right.
at the causes.
So I never got that argument with churches where they take in millions of dollars on the, you know, church spends it on X, Y, or Z. And I will sometimes hear atheists complain like, oh, well, they wasted their money on whatever, a mission trip. They could have helped the homeless. It's their money. And like, they can spend it how they want to, how they think it's important. You can do the same.
Right.
Let's see how much you're giving.
Like your money talks.
Yeah. Let me ask you, Monica, between the AHA and Americans United for Separation of Church and State, Freedom From Religion Foundation, ACLU, there are a number of groups now, nonprofit groups, that do church-state separation lawsuits to varying degrees anyway. I don't know if you guys, how you communicate with each other, do you coordinate ever? Because I assume a lot of groups are getting very similar cases. And I also assume you don't want to like just say, oh, you should go to the ACLU for that. Because, of course, you want to handle these issues, too.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you guys work that sort of stuff out? Or is it just one of those unspoken, if it comes to you, you handle it, and that's the end of it?
Great question. I would start it off by saying I wish there were even more groups, or at least not more groups, but there were more attorneys working on these issues, because our opponents are, you know, quadruple our size and have quadruple our resources and money. So the short of it is that there are more than enough cases to go around. We're I think all of the groups are turning down probably some cases that have some merit, but just, you know, we all have limited resources. As far as coordinating goes, I'm actually in regular touch with the attorneys both at FFRF and AU. Occasionally we speak out, reach ACLU, but they don't do as much church state litigation right now. I think they're focused on other issues. So it really is, I would say, kind of the three of us, FFRF, AU, and AHA, bringing, I would say, the majority of the Establishment Clause cases. And we do coordinate whenever something becomes like a public issue and it's apparent that we have the same client, or, you know, if one of us were already in the district, we're always very friendly with each other and are trying to help each other. I mean, I talk to them, I would almost say once every couple weeks. I'm talking to either someone at AU or FFRF.
Has it ever happened that one of them got a case and said, you know what, Monica would be better at handling that, or vice versa?
At times we have, especially if it is in the area that they might already have a similar case going on. What happened recently, actually, is that we decided, AHA and FFRF, that we are going to be doing a joint case involving a cross in Florida, because we had a similar client, and we just thought, you know, these cross cases can take a lot of resources, because sometimes you have to do historical research and get expert witnesses. So we actually are working on a joint complaint right now.
We're not always herding cats, and it's not always that difficult. We can work together. Are there any cases that you lost in court that you just felt so strongly like everything is on our side? There's no logical reason we should lose this case. Do you have one in mind?
Oh my gosh. I mean, yes, I have several, but I guess the one that first came to mind is our cross case, actually, in Bladensburg, Maryland. There's an enormous 40-foot cross on government property, and it's a standalone cross in the middle of a highway median. And every court that has ruled on a government memorial cross, which is what this is, has found it unconstitutional. There have been a few cases where the facts are just completely different. I want to say, you know, the 9/11 cross in the American Atheist case was one where it was basically rubble and it was in a museum context. It's very different from our case. So it was one of those ones where you just think there's no way around all the precedent.
Yeah, this is very clearly a Christian cross on government property. Right. Of course that's illegal.
Right. And to reach the conclusion that it did, the court effectively found that the cross doesn't endorse Christianity. So we're on appeal right now, and it just kind of makes you, frustrating doesn't really express how I feel about it, because you just, it's almost defeating. I mean, I put a lot of resources and time into the trial court briefs, but now on appeal, you just like, is there anything that I can say, or is it just so unpopular to rule against, rule in favor of atheists or rule against the cross?
What's your rebuttal? Just a note that says, yes, it is.
Right. Like, right. Did
I say something wrong? Is there something else I should have said? I could have done differently, and I keep coming up short because I don't get it.
The whole brief is like a guy shrugging. Right? I don't know what else to do.
Exactly.
God, a cross isn't like, where
it's
do
the
they,
letter T.
Where
don't you
do
know?
They come off? Like, who? I just don't.
Jessica's
work.
Having a breakdown right
it's
now.
Fine.
While she what is it?
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
sure.
So.
When you file all these things, when you file all these cases, there is a lot of press that comes with it. And I'm sure when you see some of that stuff, some of the press doesn't get it either. And I'm sure a lot of the commenters on those articles don't get it. What do you think is the biggest misconception about the work that you do at AJ?
Mm-hmm. I think from at least the kind of opposing side, as opposed to within the movement, is that we're somehow taking away religion, like as if there's some... that there's some existing right for them to have prayer in their classrooms and to have their crosses on government property. And so that when we bring a challenge to remove the religious reference so that the government can be neutral, it's somehow we're taking some right, you know, right in air quotes, away from them. And I think that's the biggest misconception. Of course, there's the other underlying ones, you know, that atheists are evil and we're going to hell and all that stuff. But I think from the legal standpoint, right, that's the biggest one we see.
We're legally going to hell.
Is there any...
Yeah, we're legally going to hell.
Is there any criticism you ever get from within the movement? I don't know. You said it was like, this is from outside the movement. But do you get any criticism on the work you do within the movement?
We have a little bit. I wouldn't say often, but we did, for example, when we... successfully got injunctive relief against the Federal Bureau of Prisons for discriminating against humanist inmates. Our lawsuit made legal arguments, not that humanism is religion, but that the courts must treat humanism sort of as the equivalent to a religion, which is exactly what the courts have been saying for decades. So it's not like we were actually really making novel argument. The courts have even said atheism is a First Amendment type of religion. But we had, you know, people within the movement being confused and or angry, because they don't think that humanism is a religion. And so this is sort of where those legal nuances come into play, and that you can't really just explain it to someone that we're not saying it is a religion, we're saying it should be treated like one. And so that's kind of where, I guess, we've gotten the most flack.
They're mad about the philosophical issues.
Yeah, is that frustrating?
Right.
Is that frustrating? I feel like it's like it's all pedantry. Everybody's being pedantic about, like, humanism is. Like, I just feel like that would make me bananas.
We're in
crazy.
The middle of a court case, and you're picking apart my grammar.
Right, exactly.
Sort of
yeah, and it's like,
but it matters.
We have all these options. I mean, it's like that's the way, that's the path for the legal right. outcome. I mean, do you not want humanists to have equal treatment? So it's yeah, it is frustrating, especially when it comes from within the movement, because you know it's like here I am working late nights trying to get. You know, vindicate some important established clause rights, and it's disappointing when people don't really appreciate that or see eye to eye on why it's important. But
so
you know, everyone's entitled to their opinion.
Right. Speaking on that same front, let's talk about that cross again that the lower court said.
Where was the cross again?
Did we say that it was Maryland? I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So when you're in this legal challenge against. I forgot who you are up against in that case. Was it the government that you sued?
Yes.
Are the lawyers representing the government? Do you think they genuinely believe a giant Christian cross is not really a Christian symbol?
Damn it!
Or is that just the... Sorry, I just put Jessica back into remission.
I think it's no. And actually, one of the things I keep pointing out, and I should mention to you that actually our main opponent in that case is American Legion. They intervened. But no, we have statements from the American Legion discussing this cross in particular, and even statements from the government suggesting that they not only see this as a religious symbol, but obviously a Christian one that represents Christ.
So when the
American Legion, I think, is the, you know, easy to say that because they're kind of a theistic organization.
Right.
Whatever. Nothing means anything anyway. It's fine.
Of course. It's just a T. That's what they say.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. Like,
we're just objecting to the shape of it. That's all. It's just the shape of it.
This is what I'm getting at, though. I mean, the people who work at the American Legion or, you know, Liberty Council, any of these religious right legal groups and stuff, do they genuinely, it's one thing to say they believe some of these things, you're interpreting the First Amendment or the Establishment Clause wrongly, but when they are saying, no, it's not a Christian cross, are they rolling their eyes when they're saying that, or do they genuinely think, no, this is fine, we're not promoting religion, wink, wink, like, what's going on their end?
Fuck everybody, I hate everything right now. I'm so frustrated.
I think that they definitely... No, I don't think Liberty Council, Beckett Fund, those organizations would be representing government defendants if it weren't religious, if they didn't see it as religious. American Legion certainly would not be in this lawsuit if it were a slab of concrete that did not take the form of a cross. So I think their attorneys are very... I can't speak for them clearly, but I can't fathom how they could see it any other way.
Sorry, Jessica's lying in the fetal position in the corner of the room.
I can't, like, we've been talking about this for, like, 25 minutes, and I'm fucking exhausted by it. Good for you. Like,
let me ask you one a question on the
Monica,
flip side, then.
Monica, you're the real hero. I just want to go to bed.
What's the best victory you've had so far in your time there?
Please give me good news, Monica, for, like, a second.
Oh, my gosh. I mean...
The one you're most proud of. I'm sure there are some big cases, but what's the one that, I guess, meant a lot to you?
Okay. I have to just think for just a second.
I'm just going to continue to have a breakdown over here.
It's the letter T.
Fuck that shit.
I guess, I don't know. There's different ones for different reasons. I had a very good sense of accomplishment after the Bureau of Prisons case because it was the federal government and... the scope of the relief that we were able to get is throughout the entire country. The Bureau of Prisons has agreed to recognize humanism in all of its facilities. And so I think from that standpoint, and it was a...
And that means
going
that,
up against,
that means federal prisoners who are humanists can get certain perks and benefits that previously only religious prisoners got.
Right, exactly.
Cool. That's
good. So I think that's important, but I guess... Yeah, I mean, the other one that I think was pretty significant was just a cross case that we had out in California. It was one of the first cases that I had been writing the briefs on, and I went to the trial. It was one of the first. In fact, we didn't really have trials in our cases, so it was sort of significant on its own right because it went to trial. And then when the court granted the, ruled in our favor, it was kind of across the board relief. It wasn't just, oh, this violates one part of this test. It was like it violates this, 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 and the California Constitution. So I think that was a very gratifying feeling, I guess.
Well, Well, that's awesome. And I hope you keep having these victories and don't let the frustrated alphabet rebuttals get you down.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks.
I'm sorry you had to bear witness to my breakdown. It's just been...
Thank you so much for your time, Monica. We'll have links to the cases we talked about and the AHA and the Apignani Humanist Legal Center on our show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for your time and all the work you do.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. This episode was taped at Cinnamon Sound Studios in Aurora, Illinois, and the music was written and performed by Brad Chagdis. If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a contribution at patreon.com/Hemant. That's He-Man T. We appreciate your support. I'm Hemant Mehta.
And I'm Jessica Blumke. We hope you'll join us next time.